5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I had come down this hill, I had seen this creature cross the road. It would have ripped my locked door from my truck, extracted me from my vehicle, and there wouldn't have been a damn thing I could have done about it.
This thing, I got to notice its eyes. Its eyes was real, real evil, real sinister looking. The look it was giving me.
What are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better... Sheriff, see ya!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Welcome to Sasquatch Chronicles, a place where people share their encounters. Let's start the show. Welcome to the show, everyone. Thanks for being here tonight. Hope your weekend's going well on this Sunday evening. Got a great show planned for you. If you get a chance, please visit SasquatchChronicles.com for additional shows and for interviews like the one you're about to hear. Tonight, my guest is Bob Garrett, and Bob's going to be talking about his days as a miner and some of the different things that he ran into. We'll be talking a little bit more than just Sasquatch tonight, but there's going to be a lot of Sasquatch-related encounters. Before we get to that, if you've had an encounter, email me. My email address is wes@sasquatchchronicles.com. Thanks again, everyone, for being here. Bob, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here.
Hey, I appreciate it. Glad you asked me.
Bob, I know you spent many, many years out there living off the land, living as a mountain man, up in the mountains, panning for gold, and you'd run into other miners when you were up there. Did the other miners ever talk about Sasquatch or running into these creatures?
Yes, some of the men that I knew when around the campfire and in the little cafes, you know, we would meet up and we all kind of knew each other. And I was new, and the man who taught me pretty much how to pan and hunt for gold and everything. When everybody got together, you know, they would speak about it now and then. They would, tell a story or two. And basically what it came down to, advice from these older guys. And some of them were quite old, up in their 70s, actually, and they were still prospecting. You just leave them alone and they leave you alone. They might rob your camp a little bit, take something, from you or whatever. But on a whole, if you left them alone, if you didn't shoot at them or shoot them, they normally just left you alone. That, it's just kind of live and let live.
And I know you had an encounter, Bob, when you were 16. But as you were talking with the miners, did they ever give you their impressions on what they thought these things were? What they thought Sasquatch was?
Oh, many times I heard the term as ape, man ape, and monster. But the term I heard more often than not was man ape.
Yeah, that's interesting that they would use the term man ape or ape man. And I want to get into some of your own observations when you were out there in the field. Bob, when you're out mining and living out there, tell us about the first time that you actually ran into one of these things.
Well, my first real encounter was basically uneventful, really. I was coming back to camp. I was up on the Spanish Peaks, and I was coming back to camp. I had a little claim up there. I smelled what smelled like rotten potatoes, and I had a little split trench that I was living in at the time. You know, I know it doesn't sound like much, but you know, I had a stove in there, and you know, it's kind of in the ground. I was walking back to where I was staying. I just happened to hear boulders falling, rock falling, and I looked up, and it was probably about 600 feet above me, and I could see this large dark thing making its way up above timberline, and I watched it for a while. I don't think it ever saw me. That put butterflies in my stomach, of course, you know, and it brought back memories of when I did have the encounter when I was 16. But this was much bigger than what I had seen when I was a teenager. I really couldn't make out features and things like that other than it had hands and it was bipedal and it was going up above timberline. Like I said, it was pretty much uneventful, except I couldn't sleep that night.
I bet.
I kept my rifle loaded and I kept watching the door.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Now, you were out in Colorado mining, weren't you?
In Colorado, yeah, that's where the Spanish Peaks are. It's in southern Colorado.
And before we jump into the next encounter, let me ask you, what were some of the differences that you noticed from the Sasquatch in Colorado as opposed to what you're seeing out there in Texas?
Well, you know, really and truly, I didn't discern any difference in the early days, because the ones I saw in the Big Thicket, where I had stayed for 2 years, were pretty much, I don't know how to describe them. I didn't know what they were back then. I guess now I would describe them as, you know, pretty much pretty close to the Patty film, you know, what that looks like. Now, the one I saw when I was a boy, now it had a rounder head, so it was different than these. But these were the big black, brown, normal, you know, what people talk about. I didn't really discern a lot of difference in them until I moved back to Texas and begin to do actual research here.
Was it a difference in look, or was it a difference in behavior, or both?
Well, it was. They were very different in some aspects. Many types were very streamlined, the ones that I had seen down here, and they were almost chimp-like in some ways. Some of them were kind of a reddish color, and some were dark brown, some were black. The facial features were different. Some weren't even very big, you know, 6 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet tall, and some were just huge and bulky. But the thing that that stands out to me the most is that the round head. The only time I had ever seen the round head was the very first one I saw. You know, its facial features were different. The eye color was different. The hair was different. But on a whole up north, when I was up there, they were all pretty much the same, except for possible color. You know, color was a little different sometimes.
Let me ask you, did you ever see the round head while you were in Colorado?
No, I never saw the round head in Colorado. I never did. And they were huge. They were bulky. They were tall. You know, many of them were within excess of a good 8 feet in Colorado. But on a whole, well, on a whole, they were all pretty much the same, what I saw.
So the ones in Texas you described kind of chimp-like. How would you describe the ones in Colorado?
Simply put, in simple terms, that man-like, ape-like, ape-man-like, something you would see on one of these shows that were that they put on nowadays. I'm trying to keep the word human out of it. If you understand. They just looked like wild people. Only thing is, they were just so much bigger than I was.
And I get that. You know, I can completely understand that. You know, as I talked to more and more and more witnesses, especially, I would say mainly on the East Coast is where I get a lot of this. Although I won't say I've had too many reports out of Colorado. I've had some, but not too many. Especially on the East Coast, people will say it looks, and I'll use the term human, they'll say it looks more human-like. They'll say it was a wild animal, but it looked very human-like in the face. It didn't have the apish type appearance. They'll say it looked, people will say Neanderthal, some people will say human, but there was something different about it. But to look in the face, you would think human-like when you saw it in the face. Now, you talk to someone in Louisiana or, let's say, Texas, or even here in Washington State, they'll never say that. They'll say it looked very much like a wild animal, primate, either ape, you know, human in the sense that it has a hooded nose, but not really human in the face. So you get these different descriptions from different parts of the country, depending on where you're at. Did you notice a behavior difference between what you ran into in Colorado and what you ran into in Texas? And can you talk about the differences that you saw in behavior, if you saw any?
Yes. The difference is kind of subtle with some of them. Well, let me explain that. You know, we have the big blacks here that look very much patty-like, but a little different. You know, they're all a little different. What I saw up there, and I was able to actually observe them for a few days. I was up on a hill, and the wind was, oh, you know, usually good at my, you know, coming from them instead of coming from me. What I saw was the females and the younger females. They were, they're very good to their young, it seems like. And they would put the young up into trees. You know, they would stay up there. And I presume later on, I presumed that it had to do with, keeping them safe. And then the females, they would, you know, the moms, I guess you might want to say, they would have the younger ones, you know, the babies, and they would, you know, lay out with them, and they would coo to them, and, you know, they would pet them, and they would put out this smell that was kind of like a spiced honey, but stronger, if you understand what I mean. And I presumed that that was a soothing scent to these young ones. I'm no scientist, and I can't tell you that that's what it was, but I presume that that's what the smell was. And yes, they do put out these scents. They just seem to be very good with their young, and the older ones, the males would come, or you would hear, you know, a holler off in the distance, and then they would all get up and they would all, you know, move away. I guess they were being called back. But that's some of the things that I saw, some of the things I was able to witness firsthand. And the little ones looked very much like chimps playing in the tree. They were very good in those trees.
Now, as you're sitting out there and you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're literally living off the land. You're watching this. What's going through your mind as you're watching this? Are you thinking, wow, I'm losing my mind? Or are you thinking, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen?
Well, in my mind, this really wasn't supposed to exist. And I wondered why I had never heard of this before. Why people weren't knowing this. Because I met hunters from time to time up as high as I was. And in lonely country, I'd seen airplanes come in and land in the meadows or on some of the big high lakes, and you know, hunters get out. It seemed to me like they should, you know, at least know about it. And I never could understand why we didn't know about it, why we never knew about it in school, why no one ever described it to us. I wondered what they were. You look down at them, and despite the fact that they're huge, humongous creatures, it's almost watching, if you think back in time, you would think maybe this is what it was like, you know, for ancient, not man, but, you know, man apes or whatever. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? I'm not a scientist. I don't know these words. I don't know. My feeling was, I don't know what they are. Why don't we know anything about them? They're obviously out here. Why don't we know? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Why weren't these in school? Why weren't these in the books?
Yeah, no, I completely understand that. You know, everything in life is perspective. You know, then a lot of people talk about these things as being the friendly forest people, and they won't hurt you.
Uh-huh.
And I could see, as you're looking down, watching them play with their young, I could see that having that mindset of not really seeing them so much as monsters, but seeing, you know, some sort of humanity in them when you're watching them. I think most listeners think that these things are godless killing machines. And that's not really true. I think that these things can be very unpredictable and can be very dangerous, and they need to be treated as such.
Right.
I know on the show we talk about mainly the darker side of Sasquatch and some of the bad things that happen to people that come in contact with these creatures. Not every encounter is a bad encounter. I remember I was listening to this guy one time, and he was telling his encounter about when he was a kid. And I want to say he was 6 or 7 at the time. He had left his camp.
Okay.
He was out camping with his parents, and he went out exploring, got turned around, and got lost. And so he sat down on a rock and started crying. And while he's sitting on this rock and he's crying, he describes Curious George with breasts walking up to him and picking him up. And he didn't really know what was going on at the time. He thought maybe it was a bear. I mean, you know, kid's mind, he had no idea what this thing was. But he describes it as Curious George with breasts. This creature picks him up and carries him back and drops him off on the edge of the camp. And his parents had asked, you know, they'd been worried sick. They'd been looking for this kid. And were asking him, where have you been? How did you get back to camp? We've been searching the area. We couldn't find you. And he told his dad, hey, I was out exploring. I got turned around. I got lost, didn't know where I was at. And I started crying on a rock, and Curious George brought me back. And his dad blew it off as nothing. And he was grounded, had to go sit in the tent the rest of the night. And there was an old Indian friend that they had that kind of perked up the moment he said that Curious George with breasts brought him back to camp. But you kind of had a similar type encounter when you were out there gold mining. Not so much a violent encounter, but I would consider it a positive encounter. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Oh, you know, I've never told that story. And when I have told it, I've never told it fully. Yes, they can be compassionate. They can be monsters. To give you an example of where I was going a while ago, and I'll answer your question, just, you know, I'll tell the story. But remember when the young child fell into the ape enclosure? I think in Japan, and the female ape came out and held the child and consoled it and kept the others, especially the males or whatever, away from it.
Yeah, I remember that, definitely.
Well, you know, that's showing some compassion. You know, this ape is showing compassion. Okay, well, I think it's the same thing. They can show compassion, or they can totally beat you down and eat you. You know, I think that they're very unique. I think that I think they walk primarily on the wild side of nature. But what humanity they might have in them is, you know, wild. But they're not beyond compassion, is what I'm trying to say. And yes, to get to the story, I was outside of Durango up into BLM land, up along the river. I was just inside the San Juan National Forest. And I was up, I had made a camp in an overhang. I was about 140, 150 feet above this canyon where I had come up, walked up. Now, you have to envision that, you know, this was a fairly tall overhang with a large, I guess you could say, lack for a better word, patio or you know, cliff. I was up underneath the overhang. You had to kind of, you know, crawl in and crawl out. And above that, above the overhang, you could, you know, push yourself up and you know, get up on the very top up there. It was a big table of rock, just, you know, for miles and miles, just a big table of rock. And there were pinyons, pinyon pines, and, you know, scrub oak and stuff like that, you know, all through there. And then that gave way to the forest. Well, I had noticed that there were trout in the stream that run along the wall down inside the canyon, and it run right along the wall of the canyon. I built some traps, fish traps, when it ran across it. I got back up to, you know, where I was at, and I heard those fish traps just snapping and breaking. They must have had some fish in them. I looked down and there's this hairy creature that's large, you know, as, you know, we call him now, Sasquatch. And he's just, you know, breaking up my traps and taking the fish out of them. There was just a few fish in them and they were small. But, I screamed down at him and I, threw a rock at him. I was mad. That was my fish. And I was running low. And I was about 2 weeks out of Durango, just about. So he picked up a rock. And I looked down, I hollered down, and I said, yeah, go ahead, throw that rock. I'm about 150 feet up. Let's see you get that rock up here. And it was a good chunk of rock. And you know what? He got it up there. It hit the back end of that that shelf that you know, that I was sleeping under. I picked up a rock, he picked up a rock, and I dropped my rock, and he dropped his. And then he went on about his business, basically. I went down there, and I remade those traps, and I made one bigger trap, one that his hands could get into, just to see what would happen. And after that, he would use that trap. He would take whatever fish was in that trap, but he always left mine alone. And so, you know, it went on that I would watch him. You know, I never got close to him. He would at night come up, and I could hear his, you know, feet slap, slap, slap on the rock. And he would look down at my overhang, and I had my fire outside the overhang. And one night, I love my sweets, and I would make camp bread on a stick. A lot of you campers out there and survivalists probably know what I'm talking about. But I used to like to put honey in for the liquid. If I didn't have honey, I would use cinnamon sugar, you know, and things of that sort. But it smelled nice. It smelled sweet and everything. And there's this big old hand come down off of that overhang, and he went to pick himself up a stick of that camp bread. Well, after that, I would throw it up. I would throw a loaf up there, take it off the stick, and toss it up there. And you know, he would get it because he was almost always up there at night, and you know, watching down and everything. But he never bothered me. He just watched me, watched what I was doing, watched everything I did. And I would go down and you know, I would get my fish, and he would go down and he would get his fish. I ate watercress down along the edges of the creek there. He would go down and he ate watercress too. He did, you know, he was eating up pretty much everything I ate, and we never met up, so to speak. I would go on past, and then he would come. You know, it was like he was waiting for me to go on out of the area. It wasn't like he wanted to have any kind of rapport with me, but I would take in, I had a little AR-7 that I kept in my backpack. If you don't know what that is, a little .22, and it's a survival gun, and it loads in the butt. You know, everything is taken apart, and it goes into the butt of the gun, and you can put it in your backpack. Well, I would hunt small deer with that. I would shoot them in the head because that would down them. And I never had any trouble, you know, doing that. And I would take the strap, and I would take the hams, you know, off of it, and I would usually take the fur, you know, the pelt, because I tanned that a lot. And I would come back, and it would be gone, and large footprints would be in the soil. Or, you know, are in the grass. Well, one day I did that, and I waited, and sure enough, it was him that was picking up the rest of that deer when I would shoot it, or a small elk. I followed him to see where he went, because I want to know where he was going, because he would go up the mountain. He didn't want to have anything to do with that. You know, he let me know right fast. You know, he screamed at me and stuff like that. And so, you know, I said, well, that's not going to happen. So I just didn't want to get into his, I didn't want to step on his toes. He wasn't stepping on mine anymore. And we were just going to live and let live, apparently. I'd been up there a couple of months, 2-3 months. And I had worked, you know, some places. I didn't find any, you know, gold, some pool scope, pyrite, you know, and stuff like that. Anyway, I got stuck in, I guess it was around the 1st of May or so. I got stuck in an ice storm. And if anybody knows about the mountains out there, well, May, June, you know, you can get a big snowstorm. Well, this was an ice storm. Ice storms are where, you know, there's so much moisture in the air that it forms ice on everything, on all the trees. If you're out there on you, the animals, you know, it just gets loaded with ice. And, you know, tree limbs break because they have so much ice on them, trees go down and stuff. Well, by the time I got to my overhang, and was trying to dry out and get the ice off of me, I was nothing but ice sheet myself. And at that time, I had long hair and a beard. You know, it wasn't because I was a hippie. It was because, you know, I didn't get to a barber. Anyway, I dried out, but I got a sore throat. I went on about my business. I didn't worry about the sore throat so much, you know. And I started getting a little sicker, sore throat started getting worse. It started getting a little hard to, you know, swallow food and everything. And I noticed that I was coughing real bad. You know, I had a lot of bad coughs and a lot of drainage. Wake up in the morning, couldn't, you know, had trouble breathing, you know, had to cough up a lot of stuff. Pardon me, people. But I got so sick, Wes, that I was passing out. I didn't know it then, but I had bronchial pneumonia real bad. I had a real bad case of pneumonia. I just could not. I was so sick. I just knew that somebody one day was going to look under that overhang and find my bones in my back, in my sleeping bag, you know?
Yeah, you're lucky to be alive.
Oh, yeah, I was in bad shape, buddy. And I was in such bad shape that I couldn't even crawl out there and start my fire up. And I had plenty of firewood there, because I always made sure of that, but I just could not go out there and light a match. And, you know, put some tinder out there. I just couldn't do it. And, you know, of course, I was just couldn't breathe, you know. A lot of coughing, terrible coughing. And, well, I heard something up there on the overhang. And I guess because I didn't have my fire going, I guess it made him curious of whether I was still there or not. I think he knew I was there. I think he knew I was sick. Well, this big old face looks down underneath the overhang at me, and I'm looking at him, and I guess that seemed to satisfy him. Yeah, the hairless one's sick, you know.
I realize you're sick at this point, but when you see this face look down, what did the face look like?
He looked like a, well, I'll tell you what, I'll describe it completely. He had kind of black brown eyes from what I could remember. He had fur on his jaws up to the eyes. He had a huge jaw mass, big, big, huge, you know, jaw mass or jawbone. Close cropped ears. He was black. He had a nose similar to ours, except that it was huge, and a little squat. Had kind of close in the nostrils, if you understand what I'm saying. And when he looked at me, it was kind of like, you know, he had a realization that, yeah, you know, the hairless one is sick. Okay. So that seemed to satisfy him, and he got, and you know, I heard him walk away. Well, you know, after another day or two, I hadn't been eating anything, but I had water. I had water in two canteens. I always carry two canteens with me, and I always had this large coffee pot, you know, camping pot, for, you know, that you make coffee in. But I didn't drink coffee. I never acquired a taste for coffee. I always drank tea. So I always had Lipton tea or something like that with me. I also used it for stew, and I've dug with it and everything else. I mean, it was a multi-tool to me.
Yeah, right, like an all-in-one.
But I heard this sticky slap down on the rocks right outside the overhang. Okay. This is the part I never tell. For obvious reasons, I hope. I looked out, opened my eyes, and I looked, and there's this chunk of meat. You know, it's not a big chunk of meat, but it's a fair-sized chunk of meat. And I figured, you know, it looked like elk meat. And I crawled out to it, and I passed out. Well, I was able to put that in the coffee pot, put some water in it, and I passed out. I was sick. Now, Wes, I mean, when I finally got to the hospital, they told me I was running 106 degree temperature, and that's big.
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, people die at that kind of a temperature. I mean, you really are lucky to be alive in that situation, Bob.
Yes, actually, I am, and I got the water going, you know, it was boiling, and actually I was hungry, you know, and it smelled good, and I was letting it cook down. I was just going to, you know, boil the meat, drink the broth, and, you know, chew on the meat. I didn't know what I could keep down because I really wasn't keeping anything down, even though I wasn't eating anything. I passed out. Well, it was the next day before, and it was cold, that I actually got to, you know, eat or drink any of it, and I drank the broth. I drank some of the broth. I ate some of the meat. Basically, when that was pretty much done in, done, you know, gone, I heard another slap a few days later, and I looked out, and there's this rabbit. It didn't have a head, but there was this rabbit there, and I was able to clean that rabbit. I put it in the pot, or you know, I put it in that coffee pot, and I was able to boil some of that up. And you know, in between times, I would actually pass out. I was hallucinating, man. I didn't know what was going on, but I got these greens, these herbs that were down there on my overhang that had been tossed down there, and I chewed some of them, you know. And you know, I knew that these were medicinal. I know about herbs, and these were sweet, and some were bitter. And I put them in to make a tea. I just put them in with that rabbit, and I boiled the whole thing up. And I was able to drink some of that tea. Well, I was beginning to get a little better. I wasn't out of the woods, but I was beginning to get a little better. And I thought, okay, you know, the nights have been pretty cold, but I'm going to try to, and I'm almost 2 weeks out of Durango, but I'm going to try to make it down the canyon, you know, and get out of the canyon at least, and, you know, closer to town. And so I drug myself up, and I packed up, you know, a few things, and actually I left my sleeping bag in there. I wasn't thinking straight. I had packed up my backpack, and I was dragging that on the stone. Actually, it was so hard to, it was almost like pulling a big old boulder with me, as sick as I was. And I got down finally into that canyon, and lo and behold, man, I passed out. I was sick. I was so sick. And I just knew that I was going to die here, you know, like so many other people have done, you know, and nobody will ever know where I'm at until they find my body. And, you know, it was kind of sad to me, you know, I was feeling kind of, you know, sad about it and everything. But, you know, it's the best place to die if you had to die, the way I saw it too. And anyway, I was able to drag myself up. There were times when I was actually crawling. I was actually crawling. I felt myself suspended up in the air all of a sudden. And I'm seeing the canyon is moving. I kind of go, you know, because the canyon's moving. But it wasn't the canyon, it was me. I was moving. But remember, you know, I've been hallucinating. I got 106-degree fever. I'm horribly sick. I'm dying, basically. But the canyon is moving, or I'm moving, and I can feel myself moving. And this went on for hours and hours and possibly a couple of days. And remember, though, this is what I try to tell myself. Remember, you were how sick, you know, I was. Remember, I was hallucinating and everything. I woke up. There's this little hippie chick, and we're in a school bus, and I'm in their bed, and she's trying to feed me, you know, Campbell's soup broth. And, you know, she's telling me that I'll be okay. You'll be okay. We're going to get you down the canyon. Because, you know, a lot of people would come into the entrance of the canyon, come up, you know, go up a mile or so, at, you know, as far as they could go, they were in a school bus that they had turned into a camper or an RV. The man, the young guy, he come up and he says to me, he says, man, he said, I don't know where you got the strength to jerk my bus around like that, but he said, I thought something was going to haul it off. And he said, if you hadn't have done that, he said, I'd have never found you. He said, I might have run over you. And he said, oh, yeah, and here's your backpack. He said, I found that just now. So, you know, he put the backpack down there. And I remember this. And then later on, I was in the hospital. They got me down to Durango, and they got me in the hospital. And, you know, they put tubes in my lungs. They did all kinds of stuff and, you know, dripping antibiotics in me. And it was several days before I really knew where I was at and what was going on. And that's when, you know, the doctor came in and said, you know, you're very lucky, boy or son. He said that, you know, when you came in here, you were running 106. And, I kind of told them, you know, where I'd been and, you know, what had happened and everything. And basically, you know, they just kind of shook their head and stuff. But, you know, I got better and everything, of course. But the thing about it is, and I know what you're trying to get me to tell everybody is that the Squatch, that Mel Squatch picked me up and took me down the mountain, took me down the canyon for 2 days. I don't even know if it was 2 days. It could have been longer. It could have been, you know, whatever. I just, you know, I don't know how I got there. I remember that I wasn't walking. And my only explanation is that, and this is why I tell people, I have felt, I have been on the receiving end of that compassion. I believe he did. I really do believe that he did that for me. Because, I mean, we didn't have really a rapport. I guess we had a mutual respect. You know, he didn't want me to go up the mountain where, you know, he was that. He didn't want to live with me. He didn't, you know, he was curious about me. I watched him hunt, you know, from up there where I was at. You know, we saw each other many times. And, I think that's what happened. I think that's what saved my life, was that he brought me down the canyon to where people were camping, and he dropped me off to those people.
I tend to agree with you on that, Bob. I mean, you know, with Sasquatch, let's say it's an undiscovered primate, just for the case of argument right now. Let's just say it's an undiscovered non-human primate. You know, Jane Goodall, when she went to study the chimps, she would talk about there would be crazy ones in her mind that would attack her. In fact, one almost killed her when she very first got to the island. One almost killed her. They basically beat her almost unconscious. It thought she was dead, or she assumed it thought she was dead. And she started to get back up. It came back to finish a job and kick her over the cliff. There was other chimps that she'd run into that had completely different personalities that were very much more compassionate, more not so apt to want a confrontation. They would either leave the area or they would, but the more and more time that she spent with them, she would see different personalities. So, I mean, I could see that, you know, a lot of people hear the fishing story and think you're looking at this freak of nature down there stealing your fish. Well, why not run off and why not leave? And people don't understand there's nowhere you can go. You're living in the middle of nowhere. You know, I mean, you're kind of in bed with it at that point. You know, that particular Sasquatch, you said it had more of a human-like appearance.
You know, it's hard to say that it was, that it looked human, but it looked human. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, very human-like. Not human, but kind of humanish in appearance, you know.
Yeah, right.
And that's a very fascinating story, you know, with the Sasquatch. It's almost kind of a mutual understanding that you guys had. You know, like you said, the Sasquatch must have known you were sick for it to throw up a rabbit with its head popped off. You know, we hear that story all the time. I've had guests on that say that something got into their rabbit pen and popped all the heads off of them. You know, and they've seen Sasquatch on their property. So, I mean, it's a very, very fascinating account. When you got out of the hospital, did you head back to that area?
I went back there about the next spring. I went back in there. No, after I got out of the hospital, I went home for a while. And because, you know, I still had to be careful. I got pneumonia again after that, several months after that. And there for a little while, you know, I was kind of puny. I guess you could say my resistance was rather low. And, you know, so I recuperated, you know, at home for a while. And then when I did go back, it was the next year. And I did go back up there. I did not see the Sasquatch. That's what I think you're going to ask me. But however, all my stuff was still on that overhang. I did pick up my backpack. I did pick up my a sleeping bag. That's a good sleeping bag. It's an Arctic bag. And, you know, I took that with me. And the wood was still there. Nothing had been touched or messed with, anything like that. You know, my fire ring was still there. You know, I walked back out of the canyon and, went on to another place. I kind of like to think that, you know, he knew I was there, and the fish traps had been taken out of the water and set to the side. Some of them was kind of torn up because, you know, the way they were pulled up. And I don't know, it was just kind of emotional a little bit, you know. And I really wanted to see him. I really hope that he knew that I had come back and got, you know, my stuff. But I never saw him, though. I never did.
Yeah, I would imagine from that experience, you would have one mindset looking at these creatures as opposed to stuff you've seen in Texas.
Well, that's what, honestly, Wes, they had watched me, you know, wash gold before. They, you know, they come and went. I've tracked them some. They shared the same stream I did. You know, I could be out there, you know, getting my water, and they're down about 100 yards from where I'm at, you know, and they're drinking their water. And it was kind of a live and let live. And that's, you know, that's what I was taught in the first place by, you know, the old guy who taught me how to prospect, basically, is that when you're up there, you let them live, you know, and they let you live. Don't shoot at them. Don't scream at them. Don't throw rocks at them. And, you know, things like that. And that's the way it always was. And besides, you know, there were years I never saw one. There were years I saw no sign of them or anything. And then I would go into a place and, you know, outside of Denver, you know, up in the mountains up in there, and lo and behold, you know, here's a whole track line of, you know, big feet, little feet, you know, medium sized feet. You know, there's a whole group coming up, you know, in and out of this area. And, you know, that's just the way it was.
One thing I wanted to ask you, when you were talking about the rock throwing and you're watching it throw a rock at you, how did that one throw a rock at you? I mean, was it overhanded? Was it underhanded?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. He looked like he was kind of stiff-armed, but he would throw it kind of side overhand. Do you understand what I'm saying? Kind of a side overhand. And he could throw it. He could throw it good too. But I figured out through the years that if they want to hurt you with a rock, they'll throw it that way. If they don't really trying to hurt you with a rock, they're going to throw it underhanded.
So you think there's a difference when they're throwing rocks?
I think there's a difference, yes. That's been my observation since the past years, is that you get hit with a rock, they mean it, especially if it's coming in, you know, like that. But because they can throw it hard. If you get hit with a rock underhanded, you know, it's not really going to hurt you. It's going to sting or whatever, you know. Most of the time, they don't even try to hit you. So it's just a warning.
I wanted to ask you, so when they were coming around your camp and the one miner had warned you about them, and you'd made mention earlier about them taking stuff from your camp, do you want to talk a little bit about that? What did you notice that was taken from your camp or what was gone through?
Well, they would go through my backpack. I usually had honey and also had peppermints. You know, I'm a big peppermint eater. I'd get me a big bag of peppermint, and I kept peppermints in there. And they always took the peppermints, and they always took the honey. Sometimes they would leave me some peppermints. I don't know about their sense of chivalry or whatever you want to call it, you know. But yeah, they're camp robbers, all right. You know, you get up in there, and the young ones will come in and rob you blind. My backpack had been pilfered through on this one occasion, and my backpack was an old canvas military backpack, and it had buckles instead of zippers. And they were able to manipulate those buckles, you know, and open them up. You know, it's kind of like, you know, a belt. And, you know, they were able to open that stuff up without any problems. They were able to open up my jars and pretty much anything without no problem. And I knew it was them because their hands are dirty. And they would leave dirty fingerprints on, you know, like my clean T-shirts or my white socks, you know, because I you know, always kept my clothes clean. I mean, just because you're out there living off the land doesn't mean you can't stay clean, you know. You always want, you know, your feet to be, you know, good and clean and your socks to be good and clean. I had a mirror. It was a survival mirror. They would get that out and play with it and look at it and everything. And they would leave big fingerprints on that too. And so, and also when I would be smoking meat, you know, I'd be worried about bears and flies and things like that. And here, you know, I fall asleep and I wake up and there's three quarters of the meat that's gone. And, you know, things like that would happen. And I've had pine cones thrown at me, you know, pelted at me and everything. And I think those were the younger ones that was doing that.
Do you think the pine cone throwing was just to get your attention, or do you think it was more of a get out of here?
No, I think the pine cones were shut the hell up.
Because you were loud, or?
Yeah, because I was loud. It only happened at night.
You know, it's interesting. I would imagine if I had an encounter like the one that you had, my mindset on these things would be completely different than I do now. You know, if I had that experience, I would think these things really aren't that bad. You know, this thing saved my life. And people might think that sounds crazy, but it actually kind of makes sense being that these are a non-human primate. I mean, I could see them having that type of behavior. What changed in your mind? What changed to the point where you thought, maybe I shouldn't trust these things?
Well, after what happened in the canyon is when I got a little more interested in finding out what they were and looking to see what I could find out about them, you know, looking you know, to observe them. And I just wanted to understand what they were, I guess you might say. And at that time, you know, when that happened, I still really didn't know what they were. I don't know how to explain it, Wes. I just wanted to know more about them. And that's when I started, I guess you might say, the so-called research and everything, and actually looking for them. And then in the, I had recounted that story to my brother, my oldest brother. He's passed away now, but he was a logger. He had had, you know, run-ins with them up in Oregon and Washington and places like that where he had worked. He was much older than me. As a matter of fact, just to give you a little history, he was already in the Navy when I was born. My mother had me when she was kind of old.
Yeah, surprise.
surprise. But anyway, I don't think my dad was too happy about the surprise. But anyway, I recounted that with him, and, you know, he'd worked himself through school and everything, and he, you know, he'd been in the service, and he was a doctor, and he was basically retiring at that time. He got very interested in what happened to me, and we spent a lot of time out in the wilderness together, you know, doing a lot of research and everything, and he was already looking. And, you know, knew where we could find footprints and things like that. And so, you know, I did a little work with him also.
What did your brother run into?
Oh, man. Some of his stories were crazy. He topped out the trees. In other words, he was the one that climbed way up the, you know, the big trees, and he would take the tops out of them. He had just got through topping this one tree out, and the tree, you know, of course, they sway and everything. He got up and sat down on the tree. You know, sat down on the tree top where he had cut it off, and it was, you know, it was smooth, and he'd sit down up there. And he had a safety rope on, and he had a rope, you know, that, you know, his helper had, you know, would send material up, you know, or tie it on, and he'd pull them up, stuff like that. His helper was gone, and he's looking down, and there's this maniac beating on the tree and pushing on the tree and everything, and got a hold of his rope, and the maniac had a full set of hair all over its body. And it's just screaming at him and screaming at him. And it got a hold of the rope, and the slack was being taken up in that rope. And my brother just had time to cut it off as it snapped, and it nearly pulled him down off top of that tree. And that was one of the stories that he had, the one that he told a lot. You know, that's what happened to him, basically. But he sat up in that tree, on top of that tree, and that thing beat and carried on all around that tree for practically half the night. And that's when people finally came and helped him get out of the tree. when the people came, you know, his fellow lumberjacks came, he was able to get out of the tree, and it, you know, it had run off. And he said that they used to stand up on the rim of where they were at. He kept saying that was the rim. They would scream bloody murder down at the camps. And sometimes they would throw big rocks down in the camp. So I guess they didn't like their trees being cut. I told my story, and he told me some of his, and he was already looking, and we got out there together for a while, and we looked, you know, mostly on the Spanish Peaks, up around the Greenhorn and places like that, Cadova Pass, and, you know, areas like that. We came down here to Texas, too, and we looked around a little bit, and mostly it was kind of more of a two brothers getting acquainted that really didn't know each other.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Let me ask you this. When you were out mining and you're basically hiking all over Colorado, I know you've hiked over a lot of states and you know a lot of states pretty well. And it could be Sasquatch related. It could be non-Sasquatch related. What's one of the most interesting things that you came across when you're out in the middle of nowhere?
The most interesting as far as something happening, or just the most interesting sight I'd seen?
I would say the most interesting sight that you saw.
In California, I was down in Southern California, Arizona, and I had walked into the mountains up there, and I think I may have been in Arizona at the time, or just on the border of the state. A lot of times I didn't know exactly where I was at. I know that sounds terrible, but you know, I came into a valley that it was a beautiful valley, but there was stone altars here and there in that valley. Stone buildings and things like that. That was one of the things that was very amazing to me, was to come across these stone houses and to find these altars. And I never really knew what the altars were. I presumed they were some kind of sacrificial altars or whatever.
Bob, do you think that they were Native American?
Oh, I'm positive they were Native American of some type. I don't know what type of Native American. It's funny because I never usually get lost. And I was kind of turned around in this little canyon that it was in. It was a beautiful spot, but I didn't get out. I couldn't get out of there for about 3 days. Anyway, I did a lot of looking around and everything, and I don't know what tribe it was or whatever, but there was petroglyphs. There was some really this stuff was really, really, really old, and you know when you find a arrowhead and you can tell that this is really, really prehistoric. This is really, really old.
Yeah, absolutely.
I found, you know, some artifacts like that in there too. But it took me about 3 days, you know, mostly I really wasn't worried about it, but it took me about 3 days to get back out of there. And when I did, I was just happened to get picked up by a park ranger when I got onto the main park road, and he asked me what I was doing. I told him, I said, I'm just walking. And he said, well, how'd you get up here? And I said, well, I came through the desert. He said, what? You came through the desert? I said, yeah, you know, I came from California out there and I came across the desert, which I did. And I said, then, you know, I come up into the mountains. And he said, well, you're lucky to be alive. And I said, I guess so. But I told him, I said, you know, I want to ask you something. I said, I came into this canyon. And about that, you know, when I said that, he got real interested. And I said, you know, it had all these altars here and there, and it had these, like, stone villages that were, you know, crumbled in and everything. And some of them were, you know, the walls were still really high on, and some of them they weren't. You know, a lot of them were full of soil, and, you know, things were, you know, plants were growing in them and everything. But, you know, it was like a large village had been in there. And he said, where? And he said, show me on the map. So we stopped the truck. He took his, you know, map out. And I showed him, well, it's, you know, it's about right here. He said he'd been looking for that canyon for 40 years, almost, well, you know, about 30 years. And I said, well, it's, you know, it's right here. He said, well, did you have any trouble in it? And I said, what do you mean? He said, did you have any trouble in it? And I said, well, I got lost for about 3 days. I said, which is something I never do, very rarely do, get lost. And he just shook his head, and he said, well, he said, congratulations, because you just walked out of a canyon that people call a fanyon, a phantom canyon. And I said, oh, great. He said, people go in there, hikers go up in there into these areas and they get lost and they talk about seeing, the altars and seeing carvings in the rock and seeing the dwellings like, I was talking about and everything, but they never can get back in there. And it's sometimes, that they get lost and they can't come out, and then they come out. He said, some of them are never seen again or heard of again. He said, I've looked for that damn canyon, pardon my language. I have looked for that canyon for almost 30 years. And he said, I can't find it.
That's really interesting. I wonder what you found. It doesn't really sound Native American, especially with the altars. I would have loved to have seen that. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining me tonight. Bob and I wrap it up tomorrow night. If you are a member on SasquatchChronicles.com, check it out. It'll be posted tomorrow night. Bob and I will talk about more encounters that he had when he was out mining, along with some of the stranger things that he ran into while out there. Bob, thank you again for being here tonight. And I want to thank everyone out there who's listening. If you're not listening on the site, thank you so much for listening to the show. If you're on SasquatchChronicles.com, I will see everyone tomorrow night. If not, thank you again for listening, and I will see you everyone next week. Have a great weekend, everyone. Spirit.